Good afternoon. Thank you for joining us for this series of interviews with 2024 primary candidates. We're very happy to welcome Joe Early, who's running for the U.S. House of Representatives in the 2nd Congressional District. And great. So could you please introduce yourself?
Well, first, Richard, thanks for having me on. It's a beautiful Friday out today here in the district. My home right now, I live in Bridgeport, West Virginia, North Central. So with that, I'll kind of work backwards a little bit. I'm originally from West Virginia, and I grew up in the Eastern Kanawha County coal fields around Bell, Witcher Creek, East Bank area. And after, a short stint of high school, like most public school folks, I just kind of figured out as a young man what I'm going to do with my life. And I was destined for the coal mines. That didn't work out because of actually, how God's hands touch us periodically and make us change our trajectory. So I did not make it into the coal mines and went off to the military instead. I joined the military in 1982. Spent 20 years on active duty. My MOS, military occupational specialty, is a tanker. I was a 19 series, meaning I was on the M1 tank for my career. I spent 20 years in that field. Retired as a senior non-commissioned officer, as a first sergeant. Had tours in Germany, actually with the 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment in the Fulda Gap. Two tours with 2nd Infantry Division in Korea. I've had most of my stateside tours were with the 18th Airborne Corps out of an Alva station, specifically at Fort Stewart, Georgia. And within that assignment, had a tour in Kuwait during Operation Vigilant Warrior. Wrapped up my military career 2002, after 20 years of proud service to our country. I decided to come back home to West Virginia, and I finished my education through the VA. I've got an undergraduate with the University of Louisville in training development, adult education, and then moved over into my master's program later down the road into technology management. And now I'm a cybersecurity engineer with background in weapons of mass destruction and DoD biometrics. So today I'm still serving my country, but this time I'm doing it as a defender to protect our networks and protect our and safeguard our data online as a cybersecurity engineer.
So you like do contracting with the U.S. military or things like that?
I'm a contractor that's in support of the federal workforce. That's how I like to frame it. Yeah.
All right. Well, good. Glad to hear your background. What do you think actually is the number one issue facing the United States right now?
Well, it's multifaceted, Richard. I want to start with, I think, the overarching problem that we have is we have a problem with our national identity because of this current administration has let our national sovereignty become violated with a porous southern border, lack of enforcement of our federal law on the border, and hamstringing our Department of Homeland Security with the appointments that he has in there with Secretary Mayorkas, who should have been impeached in the Senate. But obviously, Senator Schumer decided that wasn't in the best interest of the Democrat Party to pursue that impeachment. However, with that being said, our overarching problem that we have in the United States right now stems from this administration's failure to enforce federal law and to adhere to the framework of the United States Constitution, starting with the border. And then downstream is illegal immigration. We have here in West Virginia, we are definitely impacted here with the highest death rate due to fentanyl and opioid poisoning in the United States. Second to that, which is actually I say second to that, but probably running parallel, is the constraints that's put on our American energy industry, the constant regulations and overregulations that are put on to coal, natural gas, and oil that produces energy here in America, with the latest ruling that's impacted West Virginia yesterday from the EPA through the Biden administration that further constrains and restricts the West Virginia coal-fired energy plants to do carbon capture and reach some 90% threshold. Now, I haven't read the full article in detail, but that's more of a summary of it. But that's the second layer, is the American energy industry. And then what's happening at the core of our country is the fabric of our nation is being destroyed by communists.
We could bring
20 subjects off of that, just that one statement.
Yeah, I do have some specific questions. No, I appreciate getting the viewpoint. All right. So to segue a little bit, so since there's been a lot going on in Congress the last couple weeks, I want to ask you a few questions about the recent bills passed. So do you support the funding bill that was just passed, giving $60 billion to Ukraine, as well as funding for Israel and Taiwan?
Absolutely not. I would have voted against that as a West Virginia congressman. That Ukraine is not, number one, they're not a member of NATO. They're not an ally nation. They were picked by the Biden administration because of the Putin nexus of he is our enemy persona that this administration has continues to convey. But no, I would not have supported any taxpayer dollars to the Ukraine. Matter of fact, we're taking, what was it, $26 billion of that $95 billion bill. Like I said, 65% of it went over to the Ukraine. $26 billion went to Israel. And we sent $1 billion of that to the Gaza Strip for humanitarian purposes. Well, we know that that's just going to be funneled back over into Hamas. And it's going to continue to arm them and make them a threat to Israel. And Israel is our ally. Taiwan is our ally. But right now, we do not have the capability to fight a multi-front war. And that's what seems like this administration is continuing to fund these proxy wars. And then, obviously, Israel's response to Hamas, the October 7th event. And they do deserve some of our funding, and because we do support them as our friend and ally.
Okay. Yeah, that's fair. The clear description. Yeah, I noticed Alex Mooney voted for that. I kind of sent it. I don't often send emails, but I'd be rated him for it. Okay. Anyway, he's not running against you, but he's running elsewhere. So what about the recent passage of extension of FISA warrantless searches? Do you support that FISA should have been extended, or you do not support that?
I do not support snooping on American citizens with warrantless efforts. I'm totally against. I would not have voted for the extension of the FISA 702 expansion. It gives them additional 2 years and amplified it against American citizens. We have a major catastrophe going on in our country right now with the southern border. We have criminals from multiple countries around this globe that have been released into our borders, as we see it with tragedies happening all across America on normal everyday activity. Just as the most recent headlines was the Lakin Riley murder in Georgia. And, letting these paroles go out with these illegal aliens. I think it's a Fourth Amendment violation of American citizens' rights, and using the technology to double down on that. To be honest with you, I work in cybersecurity, and right now you and I are not on a secure channel. And I would tell you that this conversation is probably being monitored. This is the world we live in. And I just talked to a group last night about this same subject. And, as Americans, we have been, the proverbial frog in the pot for a long time. And what we have to do right now is we have to decide. We have got to start unshackling ourselves from the bureaucracies that continue to chain us. And, a quick analogy, and we'll we can, I'll kind of wrap with this one on the FISA 702 extension, is that between the Bible, the Declaration of Independence, the U.S. Constitution, and the Bill of Rights, that's all we really need to govern our lives as conservatives. And we end up having hundreds of thousands of square feet, actually probably cubic feet, of manuals and code and law that are continuing to be written that, basically causes us to, violate a law every single day. And this government right now is two-tiered justice, and they could pick and choose which law they want to enforce on us at any given time. We have too much when all we really need to go back is to the principles of the Bible, the U.S. Constitution, and our Bill of Rights. And that's what needs to govern our lives in this society.
Okay. Well, actually, since you mentioned that, I'll segue to one of my questions I have on here. You know, what, if anything, do you think Congress, you mentioned the Bible, specifically, what, if anything, should Congress do to strengthen two-parent husband-wife families? And kind of a sub-question that is, do you agree that the decline of two-parent husband-wife families is at the core of all societal problems? Why or why not?
Could you say that last part again? You say
so the part I was saying is about strengthening the family, two-parent husband-wife family. But also, do you agree that the decline of two-parent husband and wife families is at the core of all societal problems?
Yes, I do. I mean, there are some strong single parents out there, and I'm not going to take that away from them. But a mother cannot be a mother and a father. A father cannot take on the role of his mother. We were created in God's image as man and woman, and we were chartered to go forth and procreate and continue for humanity's sake. And, by removing that, and I point back to communism, communism wants to destroy the family. And by destroying the family, they get to destroy God in the process. And that makes the state God in their eyes. Okay. Lowercase G in their eyes, so we have to continue to fight that. And yes, the decline of the husband and wife, the mother father core of biblical principles is causing a decline in our Western civilization in America.
Yes, I agree. So yeah, I think that's good to know your viewpoint on that. So I guess this is kind of segueing or going back to the budget issues, but do you support the $1.2 trillion spending bill that was passed for the rest of this fiscal year that was passed in March? And kind of a sub question, is the current level of government spending sustainable? And what would you do about it? Go ahead.
Well, first off, I'm going to work from your last question. Is it sustainable? No. We are $35 trillion in debt. If a child that is born today, when they take their first breath, they're $104,000 in debt to the U.S. government at that point in time. And they have not even received an education, no upbringing, when they take their first breath. Imagine what that puts onto the family of those children. That's why we need to, number one, we need to reduce tax load. And I am all in favor of a flat tax and getting rid of the complex tax code. And while we work on the tax code, we substantially decrease the size of the IRS and their capabilities. They don't need to be walking around here and enforcing tax collection with the barrel of a gun. That's a Maoism type thing. We don't control society at the barrel of a gun. Secondly, is the $1.2 trillion continuing resolution that Speaker Johnson pushed forward was another one of these kicking the can down the road. What we need to do is, I'm a huge advocate for a balanced budget amendment. We need to make sure that we have a balanced budget. I believe the last time that it was done was in the mid-1990s. So we need to pursue a balanced budget, and that's going to be done by, number one, reducing taxes. Okay. And we have to create more jobs. Part of this is we need to revitalize our energy across America. And, this is everything that we're talking about now on budget, and we talk about the border, and we talk about national security, all that revolves around energy. Now, I understand we have corporations in charge of our energy industry because the government itself produces nothing. They don't. I mean, it's the corporations, it's capitalism that produces jobs. But we need to reduce the amount of regulations and constraints that we have on our energy industry and manufacturing. And we need to bring a lot of these jobs back to the United States and start doing more export of coal, natural gas, and oil.
Okay. All right. I'm glad to bring clarity to that question. What about, you know, we're talking about the excessive spending. Do you have any idea, like, how to keep Social Security from running out of funding?
Well, Social Security, you know, that's always been a contentious issue. That's one of those mandatory spending that's annually addressed because it's supposedly a guaranteed income. But, you know, it's been in danger for several decades now. These administrations wanting to dive into Social Security to take money out to supplement something else. And bouncing back, before I fully answer that, I want to go back to subsidies. One thing we also do is quit subsidizing these businesses that have unproven technologies that are just being instilled by the administration under the Green New
like
Energy.
Oh, like solar, right?
Yeah, solar, wind, iron air batteries, and so forth. But strictly on Social Security, we have a way to salvage Social Security. It's a very complex issue, but it is one of the mandatory spending areas that we have got to continue, or mandatory funding areas that by law right now has to be continually funded. And I know there are people out there, I mean, I'm 63 years old, and there are people out there my age or older that's their main source of income right now. You know, they're retired and they've put into it their entire life. So we have to salvage that. There's ways that we can address that. But on the other hand too, you know, if we did the math, just my Social Security alone, if I had the ability back in the 1970s, when I went and entered the workforce, is I was told that I have to take my money and put it into some sort of market that's going to give me a return on investment instead of giving my money to the government.
Right.
I would be able to have long since retired a long time ago. You know.
I was watching one podcast. Some people like, yeah, I mean, I'm also of, you know, retirement age. And point being, like, I know that's kind of like a hot potato. you know, but the fact of the matter is there's going to have to be some hard decisions made.
Yes.
So, I mean, for instance, if it's reasonable, for instance, say someone says, okay, we're cutting the entire federal budget 10%, including Social Security. Okay, that's fair. Do it. I mean, in other words, sometimes you have to do what you got to do, you know. I mean, you might not want to just cut Social Security, obviously, but if it needed a small cut, you know, rather than having a tank or whatever, you know. I mean, just a thought. But anyway, one question that's been, I think, is related to congressional oversight, or how do you say? Anyway, it's related to the fact that in 1986, Congress removed the liability for vaccination. And we see that a lot of people have been injured by these COVID jabs, or whatever you want to call them. Do you have an opinion on the issue of what is often called vaccination choice? I know it's not really a federal issue, but we live here in West Virginia, for instance, and we have, you know, mandates for vaccines and for school attendance, I'm talking about, and people get injured. Is that the right way to approach it, or should people have more freedom?
Well, it's funny you mentioned that. Like, we were just speaking about this last night. 1986, President Reagan had signed the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. I believe it's I call it VICAP for short. That provides a shield of liability against the pharmaceutical companies. Okay, when a child is injured or an adult is injured through a vaccination, and now I'm not a doctor, but my knowledge of vaccinations are preventative medicine. They prevent disease. They prevent the contraction of diseases. That is the definition of it. Vaccines. Now, when it comes down to parental rights, in West Virginia, our governor, Jim Justice, just recently vetoed the Religious Exemption Act for vaccinations.
I totally
disagree with that. I think that he should have signed that and codified that into law, and give that, because that Religious Exemption Act is a good first step to full parental rights over their children. Okay. I think it's important that a parent should decide whether or not that they vaccinate their child. Now, with that comes responsibility. You know, I believe that you and I probably have the one or two scars on our left arm from our shots that we took. But in my conversations with Dr. Moss and Marlene Moss, who are part of the West Virginia Health Freedom Organization here in West Virginia, there is over 70 properties now in vaccines that go into children. And look at that from a perspective of the rise in autism that we've had since 1986, okay, in the early 1990s, where we have a 1 in 36 rate in autism now in the United States, where back before the vaccination laws started to be looked at in 1986 with the vaccine injury program that's a shield against the pharmaceuticals, it was 1 in approximately 220. I don't have that data point directly in front of me. But so, yes, I believe that we need to get to a point in the federal government, and it is a federal government issue, because what happens is the pharmaceutical companies seek protection from the federal government through these programs to further push this. And here's case in point. You can watch TV outside the political season, because right now you're seeing a lot of political ads. But typically outside the political season, one thing you'll see is, oh, pharmaceutical company A, B, or C is running an advertisement to you directly as the consumer. So you can go talk to your doctor about, hey, I think I've got this illness, so we need to do self-diagnosis, and then we need to go talk to our doctor about this. Instead of it removes the doctor from the equation, the patient-doctor relationship, and their pharmaceutical companies now are advertising on television directly to a consumer, which should be against the law. It is unethical, and the pharmaceutical companies should not have the right to do that.
Okay, that's good, a clear answer. I want to get to another issue. So we've had a lot of what's often referred to as weaponization of the government. We're seeing a lot of that going on now with all the Trump cases. But not just Trump, you know, abortion protesters getting their door smashed down, things like that. So in a related area, back in 2020, when Congress was challenging, of course, when the so-called insurrection occurred, if you want to call it that. Anyway, what I'm getting at is that would you have voted like to look into election irregularities or election fraud like at that time? You know, because that's when the different senators and House members were deciding whether they needed to look into that. What's your opinion on that?
So are you specifically talking about voting irregularities using machines, or
I'm talking more like it could be a number of things. It could be machines, or I'm referring back to the proceedings like on January 6th. Of course, the whole topic is broad, but back on January 6th, 2020, there was like different senators and congressmen were challenging or seeing if they should delay the counting of the vote due to serious concerns about fraud. So you could talk to that specifically, and in general, how we can ensure election integrity.
Okay.
How about that?
Well, specifically, January 6th was not an insurrection. That would be my first statement. It was not an insurrection. It was a peaceful protest that had elements of it that had antagonists in there that caused damage to our United States property. Those can be dealt with on an individual level. However, when we jail protesters, especially peaceful protesters, with and remove their rights to speedy trial, they're now political prisoners, and we have to look at that. You know, we have that going on now. Yeah. As a member of Congress, if I whether or not I was directly in committee or subcommittee on a panel, I would have definitely voted to look into the voting irregularities that did occur during the 2020 election cycle. There was rampant fraud. There was rampant ballot stuffing, ballot box stuffing, that caused us to have a president or an administration in the White House right now that did not, in my opinion, did not receive the amount of votes necessary legitimately from the American population to warrant the Electoral College awarding of the presidency that he received. Now, I know that's a kind of a stepping answer, but I have now I'll just put it in pretty much plain English. I think that when you have corporations get involved in the election process, like Facebook did, Mark Zuckerberg putting ballot boxes out here to collect ballots, those should have been voided right off the bat. That's what the counties are responsible for. Counties across this country are responsible to ensure voter and voting integrity, and the Secretary of States at the state level have that responsibility. Corporations, when they do that, they are actually participating in the election by interfering in the election process. And corporations should be held responsible criminally against anything that upsets an election, just like or the reading of a bill or anything that that negatively impacts an official government proceeding should be held accountable.
Okay, that's clear. I mean, yeah, I agree with you. That's a serious, I don't know, what do you want to call it? A violation of the rights of those people who are jailed. Like,
right, it is. And you know, when the corporations go out here and try to legitimize their activities by saying that it's a get out to vote and doing same day registration and then you can go vote, that is disenfranchising the real American voters, the citizens of the United States who can vote, who are legitimate voters and can weigh in on the electoral process. And those corporations are violating those Americans' rights, and those should be looked into, not being a, and you touched on this earlier, we talk about justice system, and we have a two-tiered justice system right now going on, as you can see, that the prosecutorial malfeasance that's going on from the DOJ, the FBI, and across, you know, elements, courts across our country, such as New York, Manhattan, and down in Georgia, you know, and over in Colorado. I mean, it's malfeasance at its core that needs to be discussed. And then these prosecutors need to be held responsible for their actions against America.
Okay, that's clear. Agreed. One thing I wanted, we touched on briefly, you were talking about drug advertising and we're talking about the 1986 Act about liability or lack of no liability for vaccine injuries. But another aspect of that is, or part and parcel, is the what's sometimes called the capture of federal agencies. I would argue, and I want to get, of course, your opinion, that the CDC is a captured federal agency. In fact, as far as I'm concerned, they could close it down. And it's not doing any good. It's doing damage. And also, the FDA has, although it may be doing some good, has also become a captured agency, receiving many royalties and so on from pharma. What's your thoughts on that and what can be done about it?
Well, that what you mentioned right there is a problem that we have in our society, especially in government right now, is we have a conflated bureaucracy, because those agencies that you just talked about right there are part of the Health and Human Services secretary's purview. The Food and Drug Administration, CDC, National Institute of Health, Health Sciences, all of these sub-elements are the what I guess a lot of people refer to as the deep state. They're the bureaucracy. And what they're doing is these bureaucracies have usurped Congress's authority to legislate and create law. And you have these entities out here now, bureaucracies, are now running our society. And they're non-elected officials that are interpreting law or creating policy based on an interpretation of law. And then they're currently funded on an annual basis. So me, as a member of Congress, would definitely start to, I would vote to decrease and eliminate wasteful spending across the bureaucracies. And I would start with the Department of Education. We have a Department of Education here at in West Virginia that is fully functional and capable of instituting educational pursuits and framework and learning without having federal money dictate to our state how we instruct our students. The Department of Education, I believe, has an annual budget of about $85 billion, I believe. And just think about this. We could give, this was mentioned the other day by a great conservative in this state, John Racy, that we could give each state $1 billion, okay, and just say, go, you know, this is your money from the federal government, create a good education system, and then it'd be good, but hold them to that standard. But remove the federal hooks from the government, the federal government, that says, if you take my money, you have to teach environmental and social governance. You have to teach DEI. Right. You have to teach transgenderism. And you have to let the kids just, you know, be sexual amorphs in the school system and fund the libraries. One thing we need to look at, too, is the funding that the American Library Association gets that's run by a full-blown communist. Right. Now, that's one thing. Get rid of Department of Education. We need to scale back the FDA and CDC and put their capabilities underneath the core, under Health and Human Services, and not make them an actual bureaucracy. And to further that, we also need to get rid of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and allow people to exercise their Second Amendment rights if they're if they can be a legal fire owner, i.e. they're not a felon. Okay. Right. Or have committed domestic abuse, that they should be able to have a weapon of their choice, not to be ruled over by the ATF.
Mm-hmm. That's clear. Yeah. Okay. Well, as you're coming toward maybe near the conclusion, what's your view? You've touched on it some, but if you want to say anything else about your view on the current border crisis, and then also anything else that, you know, you wanted to share that we haven't really touched on, and what differentiates you from your primary opponents? Go ahead.
Well, first off, in West Virginia, we're geographically displaced from the border, right?
Right.
As a West Virginia candidate for Congress, I've actually been to Eagle Pass, Texas, because it's that important. We have, like I said earlier, we have the highest death rate from what's going on down there right now. We need to make sure that we designate the cartel as a terrorist organization. We need to make sure that China is completely held responsible for shipping over precursor chemicals and manufacturing equipment to the cartels that is pushing fentanyl into our society and killing our families and destroying our youth and killing Americans in general. So we talked about the border crisis. I think we need to build the wall. Okay. I support President Trump's deportation plan. A matter of fact, on my website, which is Joe Early, number 4, WV.com, I have a 20-point plan that includes, it's been out there for a while, and I've had this ever since I came back from Eagle Pass, Texas, includes supporting President Trump's deportation, but also I've taken it a step further. We need a 5-year moratorium on immigration in general, because everybody that's already in the pipeline can continue on through the process when they're in the legal immigration status. Let them continue on. But everything else, we put a 5-year moratorium on this because once we start President Trump's deportation plan, we need to, we're going to need that time to sort out. We have 27,000 Chinese that have came across the border. We have people from countries other than South America and Central America that have came into this border. We have a current national security threat that is throughout every state in the United States right now, and to include Alaska as well. And this is going to harm America in the long term. It's not a matter of if, it's just a matter of when. So the second part of this is, what differentiates me from the other candidates is, as a veteran, I'm a 20-year Army veteran. Okay, I've already served my country. And I've been deployed all over the world. I have a great appreciation for what it's like to truly be an American. Okay, that's just me internally. Okay, because I've been overseas, I've seen these other cultures. And I know what it's like, what we have here that some people in America take for granted. And we see that across the campuses of America right now, American universities that are turned into pro-Palestinian terrorists on campus.
Right.
So makes me different is I'm talking about policy out here with my constituents of the second district. I am talking about policy, just like we've talked here today. What am I going to do when I go to Congress? What is my platform? I'm extremely pro-life. I'm a First and Second Amendment absolutist. I believe that our rights are being violated constantly by the federal government. Our God-given rights, I believe in natural law. Okay, I am a Christian. Now, my candidate, my opposition may say the same thing. You know, they're Christian. That's great. We need Christians. We need more of us in there. But I am a person with a backbone. I am not ashamed of being a conservative. Matter of fact, I am the only America First conservative in this race. And by multiple sites out there, I'm listed as the most conservative. And I can stand in the Freedom Caucus on day one. And I know Alex Mooney is moving on to run for the Senate. But that's going to leave a huge gap in there if we get someone else elected who is not an America First conservative that can stand in there and represent West Virginia's second district. And it's, what it really boils down to is trust. I can be trusted. I've served my country and I will continue to serve my country.
Okay. Well stated. Well, I want to thank you for taking the time to come on. I'm going to make this available on any podcast platform. You can look for the Richard Urban Show. You'll find it, or on our visionroot.org in the video format. And, yeah, well, thank you again. I really, really appreciate your time.
Well, hey, Richard, thank you very much for having me on. God bless you. And more importantly, God bless America and God bless the American family.
Amen. Thank you.